Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, shared values as well as more difficult questions on the agenda as Pope Benedict meets with Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. Poverty, a virtue for priestly living, or a scourge of humanity? Find out in a new book from Franciscans International. But first, Pope Benedict looks at the life and work of Saint Jerome in his reflections at this week's General Audience. Welcome to the programme. Saint Jerome, teacher, scholar, and translator of the Bible. He was the focus of Pope Benedict's catechesis at his Wednesday General Audience this week, addressed to thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered in the bright sunshine in St. Peter's Square. Here's my colleague Emma McCarthy with all the details of what the Pope had to say.
Pope Benedict XVI continued his catechesis on the early fathers of the Church in his weekly general audience this Wednesday, focusing on the life and works of the 4th century saint, Jerome.
We now turn to St. Jerome, who was responsible for the Latin version of the Bible, known as the Vulgate.
In outlining the life and work of St. Jerome, Pope Benedict dwelt on two important elements, his devotion to the sacred scriptures and his ascetic way of life.
Jerome made the scriptures the center of his life, translating the inspired word of God, commenting upon its teaching, and above all, striving to live his life in accordance with his precepts. Born in Dalmatia in the middle of the 4th century and educated in Rome, he embraced the ascetic life and devoted himself to the study of Hebrew and Greek.
Pope Benedict continued that after a sojourn in the East, Jerome returned to Rome as secretary to Pope Damasus, who encouraged him in his work of translation.
He then retired to the Holy Land, where he founded monasteries and a hospice for pilgrims in Bethlehem. Jerome's entire life, his vast erudition and the spiritual wisdom born of his ascetic lifestyle, were devoted to the service of God's word, the refutation of heresy, and the encouragement of Christian culture.
Pope Benedict XVI concluded, "Let us take to heart the words which this great master of the spiritual life once addressed to St. Paulinus of Nola, and seek to learn on earth those truths which will remain ever valid in heaven." At the end of his catechesis and before imparting his apostolic blessing, the Holy Father greeted those present in various languages, including English.
I am pleased to greet the English-speaking visitors present to this audience, especially those from England, Ireland, Denmark, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and the United States.
But the Holy Father went on to single out one particular group of faithful among the throng.
My special greeting goes to the members of the pilgrimage group from the Diocese of Rockville Center, led by their bishop.
Well, we're here with a television studio from America named Telecare, and we're having a pilgrimage from our diocese of 130 pilgrims for the 50th anniversary of the diocese.
Father Frank Nelson was among those on pilgrimage to the Vatican from the Diocese of Rockville Center.
In America, we have a unique problem. Our parishes are very big. My parish in Long Island has 4,000 families. It's very hard to get to know everybody, but the more we can strive to understand the pastoral unity, the family of the church, the better we'll be. I think that's what Jesus wanted. So it's my first time with Pope Benedict and very excited to be part of this audience.
And after the recitation of the universal prayer, Pope Benedict XVI took his leave of the faithful and their families.
Upon all of you, I cordially invoke an abundance of joy and peace in our Lord Jesus Christ.
And my thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday General Audience. the commitment to interreligious dialogue, the promotion of justice and peace, and an endorsement of shared spiritual and moral values were at the heart of a historic meeting on Tuesday between Pope Benedict and Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. A statement at the end of the meeting said the half hour of private talks provided an opportunity to consider questions close to the heart of both sides, in particular a shared commitment to interreligious and intercultural dialogue, as well as collaboration between Christians, Muslims and Jews.
We need good relationship, and this world needs the cooperation between all those who believe in God.
Muslim professor Ezzedine Ibrahim is cultural advisor to the President of the United Arab Emirates and a signatory of the recent letter from Muslim scholars to the Pope and other Christian leaders. I asked him more about the significance of King Abdullah's visit to the Vatican.
I think it is very significant because Saudi Arabia is an important Muslim country because of the fact that the holy two mosques of Mecca and Medina are in Saudi Arabia. Also, Saudi Arabia is a seat for the Islamic conference, which brings together the Muslim states. The number is about 52 states. Moreover, Saudi Arabia has special weight among Muslim countries. King Abdullah is regarded as one of the leading figures in the Muslim world, especially among the Sunnis, who constitute at least 85% of the Muslims all over the world. So everybody will understand the meaning of the visit, which means that Muslims are willing to have good relationships with the Christians, who have been referred to in the Quran as people of faith, people of kindness and friendliness with the Muslims, and people who do not behave arrogantly. And that is in the Holy Quran. And this is not the first time that Muslims tried and successfully did it, having a good relationship with the Christian world and particularly with the Catholic world, but also all the other churches. The Prophet Muhammad wrote a letter to the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius in his days. And in the reign of the people who followed Prophet Muhammad, there were at times good relationship with the Christian world. I quote in particular the relationship between Harun al-Rashid from the Muslim world and Charlemagne from the Christian world. They exchanged gifts and good relationship. So this is a renewal of an old practice, and it is due to be renewed even more strongly.
Do you think that a meeting like this could lead to diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and the Holy See, as we've seen recently relations between the United Arab Emirates and the Holy See?
I think the visit itself is a diplomatic gesture, and it has to be regarded as such, because King Abdullah is a very meditative Islamic leader. He must have taken a decision that a good relationship should be established. To which level of diplomacy, I cannot suggest, but I think it will be a change in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the Holy See. And it would also invite all Muslim states to observe the good relationship with the Christian world as one of the objectives. After all, I'm sure you remember that there was a letter signed by 138 scholars, myself at the bottom of the list, calling for friendship between the Muslim world and the Christian world. That was the call from scholars. Now you are getting a call from the political leaders. And when you have a political gesture supporting or being supported by academic gesture, I think it is meaningful. And this world needs the cooperation between all those who believe in God.
As you know, Pope Benedict and other Christian leaders have often called for much more freedom for Christians in Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries too. And yet this seems to continue to be a big problem. Why is this?
I think it is an imagined big problem. I happen to be by job a man who traveled all over the Muslim world. And in all Muslim countries, religions are free and worshipping is free, even in Saudi Arabia. After all, I taught in Riyadh University for a number of years, and my Christian friends were saying their prayers and presenting their worship in Riyadh.
But only in private, surely. They're not allowed to worship in public places. Or...
Well, it is in public places, because judging by what I have seen, because I had many Christian friends, some of them were academic staff with me, and I know that it was public places. It was not secretive at all. Everybody knew about it. The only reservation has been, and I think will continue, be in two cities. One of them is Mecca, where you have no Christian at all, and the other is Medina, where there is no Christian at all. It is similar to the possibility of a Muslim saying, why don't we can have the freedom of establishing a mosque in the state of the Vatican? That would be a silly request. What for? So in Saudi Arabia, facilities for prayer do exist, and in all other Arab and Muslim countries, facilities in the shape of establishing churches is there. In Abu Dhabi alone, we have, of course, the Catholic Church, and we have the Coptic Church, the other churches, I think about five of them at least, in Abu Dhabi, the city of Abu Dhabi, not to mention Dubai and other cities. So the question is, do we need to establish churches or only facilities for worshipping in a place which has got a religious significance? I am sure that King Abdullah is a very powerful man of decisions. He will face this problem. But I would like, through this channel, to say freedom of worshipping is secured in the constitutions of all Muslim and Arab countries.
Muslim Professor Ezzedine Ibrahim. But Christian leaders in the region have very different views on the problems of religious freedom. Though the Saudi government may in principle uphold the right to private worship for non-Muslims, in practice it's often hard for Catholics to pray together and to celebrate the Eucharist with few priests allowed into the country.
Because we have surely more than 1 million foreign Catholics in the country working there in on different levels, and I'm only expecting that these people can express or at least exercise in a secure way their own religion.
Bishop Paul Hinder is Apostolic Vicar of Arabia, based in Abu Dhabi, and responsible for Catholics in 6 Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, I think there are difficulties on different levels. First of all, there is no public expression of the of a religion. Officially allowed is only a very private expression of religion, of other religions than Islam, but there are no secure rules regarding the character of this so-called privacy. We don't know how many people are allowed to gather. It's not clear where they have to gather. Is it allowed only in private houses, or may they rent a club, or can they rent a hall, and so on? Well, what is the level, the volume regarding the voices when they sing, and so on? There are a lot of insecurities, and there may be the police, the religious police, who intervenes, or although the neighbors are not happy about, others are very tolerant. That's one of the practical difficulties. Then a major difficulty is that we can't have our personnel there, because as a Catholic Church, we need for this million people, we should have priests which can celebrate the Holy Eucharist, not as a provocation for the others, but at least for our own people, that they can get more facilities. Now, it's only occasionally or for a very limited people who have this possibility.
What about you as a bishop? What kind of freedom do you have to be able to operate in any way there amongst your people?
Yeah, that's equally very limited. But I don't like to express myself about this topic because it's rather delicate. Maybe that after the visit or in some months it's easier to answer to this question. I have been in Saudi Arabia, there is no doubt, but how I am moving and so on, I don't like to speak about.
Are you able to tell me anything about the relations that you have with perhaps government officials or Muslim leaders in order to try and negotiate some more freedom for your people?
In Saudi Arabia directly, I don't have. Of course, living in other countries, I am residing in Abu Dhabi, and I am responsible as bishop for the Catholics in six countries. I have quite a regular relationship with people from the government, so also with religious leaders. That is not the question. They are very friendly. Saudi Arabia constitutes until now a particular case because it was not so easy to get in touch officially as a bishop. And I hope that the visit today will open more facilities also to get in touch with the people to speak about common problems I have.
Do you see the establishment of diplomatic relations between Saudi Arabia and the Holy See as the first step, really, to opening these kind of negotiations that you're talking about?
I don't know if it is the first step or maybe only the second. It could be that the Pope is also telling the King, yes, diplomatic relationship, why not? But I would like to see at least some progress on the other level. I don't know. I am not informed about the agenda of the meeting. But I do think that a diplomatic relationship will come one day when, simply I don't know, maybe it's relatively soon, maybe it takes time, because it's not, we have always to see it's not easy also for Saudi Arabia after so many years of a certain policy in religious matters to do this step that I can understand. But I think Saudi Arabia itself has a certain interest to go forward to better relationship.
My thanks there to Bishop Paul Hinder, Apostolic Vicar of Arabia. And earlier you heard Muslim Professor Ezzedine Ibrahim of the United Arab Emirates. Poverty, a virtue for priestly living or a scourge of humanity? Well, both, according to a new book of reflections on poverty compiled by Franciscans International, a non-governmental organisation representing friars and sisters working in countries all over the world. The book, launched at the United Nations in Geneva recently, contains stories from a dozen different countries across the globe where poverty continues to plague people's lives, from Asia, Africa or Latin America to our so-called wealthy Western nations in Europe and North America.
Poverty is not just in the South, it's also in the North. And that is something the Franciscan community knows, because they know the marginalized people, even also in the North, and they know this poverty that is sometimes hidden. And one of their aims is also that this poverty is revealed and that these people are listened to.
Michael Mutzner works on advocacy for Franciscans International and is one of the editors of this new book, World Poverty, Franciscan Reflections.
Poverty is a very important issue, of course, for the Franciscan family, and we represent the Franciscan family at the United Nations. So having a book on poverty can seem quite obvious, I would say, for an organization like us. But what's interesting in tackling this issue is that Franciscans also have an interesting approach towards poverty, because on the one hand, they will say that poverty is a value, is an ideal for Franciscans. And at the same time, what we are saying is that a certain form of poverty has to be combated. So this is a little bit one of the issues we tried to address in this book. What represents poverty for us, and when is it a value, when is it maybe something that has to be addressed?
So almost a paradox, you're saying, at the heart
There's
of this whole question.
Exactly. There's a paradox. And actually, the book is opening with an article from Tade Matura, OFM brother, who addresses right this question about this paradox of poverty. The other articles then are more experiences from the field, from grassroots Franciscans and sisters around the world who tell about their experiences and the people they are living with.
Can you share some of those experiences with us? Can you tell us about some of the most perhaps significant examples of brothers and sisters working to combat poverty in countries around the world?
Yes, some Franciscans are telling about their personal experience. I'm thinking, for example, of Sister Alfonsa Fatima, who's an FMM sister from India. She chose with her sisters to live among the Dalits, so an excluded community in India. And she lived with them, and she learned them to gain confidence in themselves and to fight for their rights to be treated as human beings, because it was not the case before. And she worked especially with the woman there who they had a very difficult situation, and they were able to improve the situation through their work. And she tells a lot about her personal experience. And then there are articles who talk more about a situation without being a testimony of a personal experience. So, for example, there is an article on poverty and aging, because we think that poverty is a problem as well in the south as in the north also. So there's an article, for example, on poverty and aging in France and how these people are excluded and suffer from being marginalized and having a lack of resources to live in full dignity.
But are these mainly examples of where Franciscans have been able to make a difference? In other words, stories of overcoming particularly difficult situations of poverty?
Sometimes yes, and sometimes it's just a constat that's how things are, and it's a kind of appeal also to work maybe on another level. And this is also the complementarity between Franciscans International's work and the work on the grassroots, because there are some problems that need to be tackled at a structural level, at the international level, because changing things at the grassroots sometimes are not possible when the structures are wrong. So there are both these dimensions also in the book.
If you're talking about tackling the structures, there is a growing awareness, isn't there, at international level, within the UN and so on, of the need to really tackle these issues of trade and debt and so on. And yet it doesn't seem in many cases to be making a difference to people living at the grassroots.
That's true. It's because progress are always slow and difficult, but yet progress are existing. And maybe I can tell about one of our latest success, which was to contribute very much to the creation of the mandate of a special rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery. This is a problem. Millions of people are affected by contemporary forms of slavery, be it prostitution, smuggling, forced labor. Millions of people are affected, and now we were able to appoint a special rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery. He actually, the person will be appointed, but the mandate has been created by the Human Rights Council. And this rapporteur will be able to visit the countries to see the situation in the field and make recommendations to the state.
So this is an example, as you say, of a small but significant victory in the fight against eliminating this kind of trafficking and this modern form of slavery.
Yes, absolutely. This rapporteur will have some publicity. Actually, the Human Rights Council is working with a whole set of rapporteurs. And there's also one on extreme poverty. And we also are lobbying this independent expert about issues of poverty. We have written, based on the contribution of members of the Franciscan family, a position paper on extreme poverty and human rights. And we submitted this to this independent expert, and he has taken our recommendations into account, into his work, and in further also defining the concept of extreme poverty, and, for example, the issue of discrimination, which is a very important issue to us, because we think that often poverty is a consequence of discrimination, and also poverty by itself often causes discrimination. And so we ask him also to study further this issue.
You mentioned at the beginning that you bring a very particular Franciscan perspective to this whole question of poverty. What particular emphasis, perhaps, do you give to your work that distinguishes it from other NGOs working on this issue?
Yes, I think it's very much like this book shows it, this experience from the field, because what we do here is really be a vector of what's going on the field and just be the voice of the Franciscans themselves on what they experience on the field. And this book is also a way to do it, because we contacted Franciscans, members of the Franciscan family on the grassroots, and are bringing their stories at the UN. We launched a book. Some of the Franciscans, authors of the book, were here, were able to speak in front of the international community, of the representative of the diplomatic missions. And I think that this is a specificity of Franciscans' international work, is to be based on this large membership of Franciscans, of members of the Franciscan family. And it's really what makes also the richness of this organization. We have so many people working in so many different fields, in hospitals, in education centers, working with migrants, with people victim of trafficking, working with the poor, with children abandoned in the streets, and so on. And I think this is really what makes the richness of this NGO.
Thanks there to Michael Mutzner of Franciscans International. And you can order a free copy of that book, World Poverty, Franciscan Reflections, on their website, www.franciscansinternational.org. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the website www.vaticanradio.org/English. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.